The Bloodstream Podcast is made possible exclusively by Shire, and for that we say
thank you, Shire.
Thanks, Shire. Should we get on with the program now, do you think?
What program?
The Bloodstream Podcast, episode 16.
Oh, yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 16, September 18th, 2017. I am your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, Andy Slavitt, the former head of Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act under President Obama, joins us for a very special interview segment on the importance of the ACA for people with hemophilia and other chronic disorders, and provides guidance on what we can be doing to help support it. From across the pond, community advocate Lawrence Woolard provides insight into the UK bleeding disorders community and his personal journey in hemophilia. From across the recording table, Natalie leads a New York Times story on the debate surrounding how to price gene therapy treatments now that the first ever, a leukemia treatment, is FDA approved and on the way to market. And I provide an overview of the recent terrible news of a patient death during the fitusiran trial. What happened, what's it mean, and what happens next? All that and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. Natalie, we're in the fall.
I know, that's awesome.
Labor Day's come and gone, kids are going to school, not ours because they're not on the planet, but those that exist and are part of the school system. It's back to this time of the year. But before we kind of embrace that, the summer did end with quite a bang.
Sure did.
NHF's annual meeting in Chicago. Big meeting, busy meeting. We talked about it on the episode 15. We were, as Believe Limited, quite busy there. A lot of responsibilities. I think it went well. From my perspective, it went really well.
I think so. Everyone I spoke with felt positive.
There's good enthusiasm. Yeah. There's really good enthusiasm. What? Any particular highlight for you? This was your third NHF annual meeting?
Yeah, which feels... I know. But first time I had an active role and as a facilitator, teaching yoga.
Yeah, how'd that go?
It went well. I felt a little nervous about it just because I didn't know, you know, would 5 people show up? Would 100 people show up? And, you know, teaching a yoga class of different sizes is different.
On different experience levels.
Right.
Right.
Like a lot of variants in that room. And there were people with different experience levels. Some people who had never done yoga, but the nice part is I got to actually walk around before both classes and, you know, introduce myself and just get a quick read on what the participants' experience level was and kind of reassure them that, you know, if you can't do the poses that I'm calling out, you can breathe and it's still doing yoga.
Right.
So, and you know, I watched that happen and that felt nice that I had the individual one-on-one to say that with them before the class started.
Good.
Yeah.
Good, good. Well, I think that's awesome.
So Patrick, what was the highlight for you?
I guess if I had to boil it down to a singular highlight, it would have to be the breakfast symposium where we debuted the making of video for Bombardier Blood, talked about the project, and Chris and I were a part of a Q&A with a packed room at a very early hour and a very emotional room after that video played. I've never been in a room where someone in the audience was like, we all need to get up right now and give these guys a round of applause and coerced the entire room. And it was, I don't know, 150 people in that room, something like that.
I feel like more.
More into standing up in a big round. And it wasn't as though like she was alone. I mean, she was alone in like leading that, but no, it wasn't like a thing. Like everyone's like, yeah, that's what we do next. I have never seen that happen.
Yeah, it was special.
It was very, very cool. If you'd like to check out the video, it is on the landing page of bombardierblood.com. Again, that is our documentary film about Chris Bombardier, the first person with severe hemophilia to summit Mount Everest. And hey, fun update for you. We just found out earlier this week, we're recording this podcast on Wednesday the 13th, that Chris has been accepted to climb Mount Vincent. You may recall he had been denied climbing Mount Vincent, the summit in Antarctica that's a part of the seven summits, tallest mountain on each of the seven continents, because he had hemophilia, despite having climbed all the other seven summits except Mount Everest. Now that he's climbed Mount Everest, Antarctica has given in, and they said, okay, you can climb us too. So he will be going to Antarctica in December to complete his seven summits climb, and yes, we will continue to give you updates here on the Bloodstream Podcast.
Which is awesome, because it's 250 people in the world have ever done that?
Something like that. Yeah. 250, 300 people, like a very small amount of people.
And zero people with hemophilia.
Correct.
So super cool.
Keep it going, Chris. Hey, speaking of super cool, we have a super cool guest today. Our sit-down segment interview guest is Andy Slavitt. Andy used to run Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act under Barack Obama during the Obama administration. Since he has returned to the private sector, he has a couple different roles, and one of them is speaking and defending the Affordable Care Act. So he's going to be on later on to talk about the Affordable Care Act and its impact on chronic disease communities, including those of us with bleeding disorders. So that is super cool. I'm a fan of Andy's, been following him for a while on Twitter, and pretty cool get for the Bloodstream podcast. So one more bit of timely news to address. As we said at the top here, it is the fall, and unfortunately the fall also means that it's hurricane season. And it's not just hurricane season. You know, if you live in Los Angeles, like Natalie and I do, we're prone to earthquakes here. If you live in places in the middle of the country, we're prone to tornadoes. So emergency preparation is something that we in this community just generally need to be thinking about. And NHF has recently re-released some materials on emergency preparation for families affected by bleeding disorders, what you need to know. We have a link in the program notes. So maybe just take a minute, take a look at that, and just run through the checklist in your head. Are you and your family ready in the event that you are facing an emergency and have to move kind of quickly?
Yeah, in the last 2 weeks, we've had two really big hurricanes to start the season off that were devastating to both Florida and Texas. You know, and I think there's always a call to give when these things happen, and sometimes you don't know who to give to.
Right.
The Red Cross is great, or the big organizations do a lot of good, but sometimes it's nice to give to a community that you belong to, even if you're not living in those areas.
And necessary too, right? Yeah. Like it's good. It's also necessary. They need help too.
Right. So it's a directed give. And if you're interested, we have links in our program notes of how you can give to both the Florida and Texas chapters. If you want to help the families that have been devastated by these two events.
And now just a couple of housekeeping items from Bloodstream Media. We have a new episode of the Powering Through podcast, Powering Through Pod episode 8. We're on 8 already. Woo-hoo! Over there at Powering Through, featuring Josh Gordy. That was a really nice sound. Hope Foundation founder and NFL Super Bowl champion, and Justin Moore, a DEA agent from also known for his work on DEA Detroit, a show on Spike TV. Both a DEA agent and a television star. Very impressive guy, that Justin Moore. And Ask the Expert, episode 6, featured Carrie Koenig. It was on Back to School. We received some really nice feedback from that, so thank you for that. That episode is still up and on the landing page at bloodstreamexpert.com. Coming up later this month, Ask the Expert, episode 7, features Randy Curtis for our Aging with Hemophilia episode, or as Randy may call it, the Old Geezer episode. And I say that in jest. That's the way Randy refers to himself and his cohorts. But we wanted to talk to Randy about what are some of the top of mind considerations for guys in the baby boomer or Generation X populations of the community. Talk a lot about new therapies and some of the developments that will particularly be helpful to our teens and our kids and future generations. But what about those guys in the baby boomer and Gen X populations? What are they thinking about in 2017? Randy gives some great insight on that, and that episode is coming out later this month. And then lastly, Stop the Bleeding, a property of ours through the Greater Believe Limited world. We've started releasing some behind the story, little 2-minute videos of that correspond with each of our 10 episodes that give you insight into the way that we've balanced the sincerity and the truthfulness of the themes, things like mental health and depression, dating and disclosure, as well as the entertainment and the comedy that comes with the promise of what the show is all about. How do we kind of balance those two things? These 2-minute videos give you a little bit of insight with interviews with actors, writers, and our director, Jim Fagan, on how we've gone about our process. And you can find those on our Facebook page, facebook.com/stbhemo. And with that, we've concluded our opening, and we will move into, Natalie,
the like, share, and comment segments.
That's a very interesting pacing choice you made. Very good. Like, share, comment, coming up next.
So this month's like segment comes from the New York Times on September 11th, an article titled "New Gene Therapy Treatments Will Carry Whopping Price Tags."
Whopping price tags.
Yes.
Whopping. That's a big word.
I mean, it's an emotive word.
It is an emotive word. I'm having some feelings already. Tell me more.
So the first gene therapy treatment in the United States was recently approved by the FDA, and there are 34 that are in final stages and 470 that are in initial clinical trials. So this once futuristic era of medicine is now here. And why this is important is the first one that is out is for a leukemia treatment, and it carries a price tag of $475,000, and that's whopping.
That's a whopping price tag.
And there's one that's for blindness, and it's estimated to cost between 700 and 900. And that one's not out yet, but I think that one might be one of the ones in the final stages, and that's why that price tag is being finalized as well. So why this is important to our community is, I mean, the fact that there is a therapy out right now and it has a official price tag is a good thing to put on our radar for treatments that could be coming out for our community and what they may or may not cost.
What were some of the debates around costs that came up in the article?
So, you know, drug makers say that they argue that the prices ought to reflect the value of curative treatment to the patient, first and foremost. And, you know, there are people like Dr. Aaron Kesselheim. He's the director of program on regulation therapeutics and law at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He argues against that, and he's far from convinced. He says, we don't pay for the fire department in that way. When a fire department shows up at a burning house, they don't ask how much is it worth you to put out the fire, you know? So
right.
It's, you know, an interesting thing. And this new era of medicine ushers in, you know, moral, ethical, as well as financial concerns. This article that the New York Times put out last week, they focus chiefly on the financial aspects. And then drug makers are also saying, like, we need to have these drugs cost this much because we need to be able to fund future research and development, which is a fair argument. We do want to keep we want to keep curing diseases.
Absolutely.
But you know, that's also that argument can be broken down too, because there are already huge financial incentives for the development of orphan drugs and for rare disease community treatments. So, you know, with there's tax credits, 50% tax credits for some of these drugs for the research and development aspects of it. So I just think it's important now that there is a drug, a gene therapy drug, on the market, and ours are in the wings waiting, that we start paying attention to what they'll cost and the arguments of, you know, from both sides and from, you know, how are they going to be paid for? The article talks about one suggestion of it being treated like mortgage for the
like
treatment.
Having a mortgage?
Having a mortgage, yeah. So, you know, and then that brings up a slew of considerations. So it's an interesting article and a conversation that we need to start having, because these will be available for our community, not like hundreds of years
soon.
From now, soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, fingers crossed if all goes according to plan, more or less. And it's interesting too how we're at the advent of or the very beginning of this new era of medicine, as you put it, this once futuristic era of gene therapy, something on the market. So we're going to be talking more and more about this in general, and healthcare is going to continue to be something that we societally are looking to tweak, modify, change, improve, enhance. And those two things are going to be happening side by side. So it'll be very interesting to see kind of like where healthcare, health policy goes in the next couple of years, side by side with this new era of medicine, which has already arrived.
Exciting.
Our episode 16 share segment is brought to us from across the pond in London, England. Lawrence Woolard is a hemophilia advocate and the director of On the Pulse Consultancy. He provides us some background on his family's history with hemophilia, his journey into becoming an advocate, and the greater UK and European communities, the organizations, and the issues they're dealing with today. So we will turn it over to Lawrence to give us a little bit of a look into what's going on across the pond. Take it away, Lawrence.
Hello, I am Lawrence Woolard, Director of On the Pulse Consultancy. We're a UK-based organisation working to improve the patient experience in hemophilia. It'd be silly of me not to first mention the recent excitement around the Duchess of Cambridge expecting another baby. Having attended the World Federation of Haemophilia Congress in Orlando last summer, I know how fond Americans can be of our monarchy. It is well known that haemophilia was carried through the royal family. I have to say, without committing treason, that Patrick, as a fellow haemophiliac, is every bit as much royalty to me. So I'm honoured to be able to share my perspectives from across the pond for Bloodstream. My path into advocacy was cemented with the Haemophilia Society. They're the only charity for everyone affected by bleeding disorder across the whole of the United Kingdom. With a team of dedicated staff and a network of super motivated volunteers, they can offer vital help and support where needed to its over 5,500 members and the wider community. In July, the news broke that a public inquiry, a legal investigation conducted by a judge appointed by the government, will be held into contaminated blood products. As in America and many parts of the world, a large proportion of blood products supplied to patients during the 70s and 80s in the UK were infected with HIV and/or hepatitis C. This is bittersweet for the Haemophilia Society and activists who have been campaigning tirelessly for answers over decades long. Thousands of people, the majority with haemophilia in their families, were and still are devastated by this tragedy. Sadly, this includes my own, with my mum losing both of her parents. Consequently, I never got to meet my granddad and often wonder about what his life was like with haemophilia at my age in 1953. Back then, there was no such thing as preventative therapy, and when he had a bleed, all he could really do was have bed rest and see it through. What would he think of my haemophilia treatment and care today? As a moderate, but with a severe phenotype, I've been able to self-treat prophylactically since I was around 10 years old. Just recently, through personalising my care plan with my specialist clinical team, I've been able to switch to an extended half-life product, which are now on licence here. This has meant that I no longer have to infuse daily, whilst offering me a certain level of protection. However, availability of these and even standard factor concentrates that are safe and sustainable vary across Europe. Organisations like the European Haemophilia Consortium, based in Brussels, the hub of the European Union, exist to fight the health inequality amongst approximately 90,000 people diagnosed with a rare bleeding condition that they represent. A snapshot of the disparities in access to treatment and health services across Europe is illustrated in the EHC's documentary, Haemophilia Stories. It is a really eye-opening and emotional account, and validates why having a voice is not a choice to some, but a necessity. I really urge you to watch it. In October, the EHC are hosting their annual conference in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania in Eastern Europe. This is an important forum for patients, healthcare professionals, the scientific community, and the pharmaceutical industry to share expertise and address unmet needs. I understand that Lithuania itself, since first hosting the conference in 2009, now provides prophylactic treatment to children and adults. I have the privilege to be speaking as part of a company symposium about the patient journey and overcoming the remaining milestones in haemophilia care from a patient perspective. Meetings like that of the EHC do also give a platform to showcase the latest flurry of research and innovation in haemophilia, with the hope that new therapeutic options could dramatically change the treatment landscape on a large scale. In fact, it was only last year at the same conference in Norway that I first heard cure of haemophilia by gene transfer becoming a reality, something certainly my granddad would never have dreamt possible. The quest to meet patients' expectations for the future is somewhat evident from the ongoing clinical trials that I know of in the UK, especially for my friends and peers with inhibitors. Although I know personally that progress can come at a price, such poignant losses must not be in vain. We have come this far. Let us not stop now.
Thank you, Lawrence, for that piece and for giving me the title of royalty. Natalie, I don't know if you heard, but you are now, you married into royalty.
That's amazing. I had no idea.
I would like a little more enthusiasm in your voice when you tell me that it's amazing to have married into royalty.
That's amazing.
Thank you. That feels, my ego is feeling much better. Anything that stood out to you or that you want to underscore from Lawrence's piece?
I mean, now that we're talking about royalty, I am excited. You know, Kate Middleton is pregnant again. And, you know, what if the baby has haemophilia?
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
I'm starting rumors now.
Yeah, like we took that. It went from an eye roll to a lean in on my end. I like that. Okay. You know, I thought another thing that Lawrence said that I thought was interesting, like his grandfather, what would he think is possible?
Yeah, definitely stuck out to me.
Especially, you know, just doing that like segment on gene therapy and that being right here and, you know, talking about the trials and the evolution of therapies. There was a lot in what Lawrence had to say that kind of intersected with other stuff we've talked about today.
Well, and even the fact that he's on a long lasting product, long acting.
Long lasting, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I know. I think there's a Seinfeld bit about this somewhere, but in our community, it's called long lasting factor.
Cool.
Extended half life, you know, choose your terminology.
Yeah, but, you know, that that even that, like, I'm sure his granddad would be like blown away.
Absolutely. So. Totally.
Yeah, well, it was great. It was great. And of course, his accent was adorable.
Thank you, Lawrence. Appreciate the contribution and appreciate you supporting the Bloodstream podcast. And for our comment segment this month, as has been pretty widely reported in Hemophilia News Today, The Rare Disease Report, Fierce Biotech, and many other outlets, Alnylam suspends all trials of fitusiran after Hemophilia A patient dies in phase 2 study. So, quick background, if you're unfamiliar with fitusiran, which is one of these non-factor replacement therapies currently in clinical trials, I would highly recommend you listen to the interview with Dr. Stephen Pipe that we did on episode 14 of the Bloodstream podcast. We repurposed that interview because we found it so valuable for our Ask the Expert podcast, episode 5, as well, where it's a bit more isolated, maybe easier to find quickly. So links to both will be in the program notes. I would highly encourage you to listen to those. He spends most of the 30 minutes discussing emicizumab and fitusiran and these non-factor replacement therapies. And he is a leading expert. He's the chair of NHF's Medical and Scientific Advisory Council. So listen to those if you're unfamiliar with fitusiran and Alnylam. But basically, here's what happened as reported by the Rare Disease Report. The patient had an exercise-induced right hip pain that occurred and was treated with 3 doses of factor VIII on 3 separate days. During the 3rd dose, he developed a severe headache. CT imaging led to a diagnosis of a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And Natalie, can you help us understand what that is exactly?
Yeah, it's one of the 3 membranes that separate the brain, that are between the brain and the skull, the pia, the arachnoid, and the dura mater.
So somewhere in there, the hemorrhage occurred. The patient was hospitalized, continued to receive factor now 2 to 3 times daily. However, his condition worsened for 2 weeks until he unfortunately died. So what does that mean? Well, several things. Firstly, it means that the fitusiran clinical trials have been suspended. So there were 2 trials going on, an open label extension phase 2 study that this individual was a part of and had been for quite a while. And then there was a phase 3 study that had just begun this summer. Both of those have been suspended while additional analysis and investigation occurs to determine what exactly happened, as we now have more than a handful of thrombotic events that have occurred with non-factor replacement therapies in clinical trials. It's very important that we get our arms around what this means. What else does this mean? It means that the 32 other patients who were on this trial for almost 2 years, with as of July, as reported at ISTH, no thrombotic events, are no longer going to be on fitusiran. And their lives have now been changed a bit by this, and their families' lives have been changed a bit by this. It also means that anyone who is enrolling in that phase 3 trial, their lives have been changed by this. But most notably, it means that a second patient has died in the last 12 months on clinical trials.
I mean, it's terribly sad, the loss of life at any point. But in order to advance medicine, we need to have these clinical trials. And in order for there to be good outcomes, we need to be able to develop new treatments. So while it's never easy and it's never okay, like never feels okay when someone's life is, in this case, sacrificed because he did have other options and he chose this and made a sacrifice for the community at large. And in a way, that's really beautiful.
And that's a point that, you know, I've heard a few people make, and it's important that we recognize and appreciate the sacrifice, because clinical trials do come with risks, the most severe of which, of course, is death. And in this case, this individual, that was his outcome. So look, I think one of the biggest long-term important takeaways for us from a community standpoint is that we are educated on what a clinical trial is, what it entails, what potential outcomes can be. For example, if, like I mentioned, these 32 other patients now, they have had experienced no adverse events, but they are no longer on this medication. And if things don't proceed in a certain way, it may never be available to them. So it's a big deal. So be educated and you can get educated. Be educated, he says. I'm going to end this with some demands. But there are resources that you can tap into to learn more about clinical trials. NHF's HemAware, their quarterly magazine, published a Clinical Trials 101 piece that is well worth the read. And likewise, HFA has a clinical trials page on their website, both of which include things like questions you should be bringing to your doctor, considerations, potential risks, potential outcomes, length of time it may take, ways it'll influence your life that you might not be thinking about, and all those kind of important things. So if you are thinking about enrolling in a clinical trial, number one, thank you as a community member, because without people enrolling, developments can't happen. But be aware of what it entails. Check out the links in the program notes to these resources. Ask questions of your doctors. Ask questions of community leaders with expertise in this area. And again, I'm sorry to hear of this patient's death, and I'm sure his family's going through a lot right now. We keep him in our minds, and we appreciate the sacrifice he made for the development and the betterment of this community, and we won't take that lightly.
Yeah, we thank him.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so moving on from our like, share, comment segments for episode 16 into our special sit-down interview segment with Andy Slavitt, which I am really excited about.
You should see his face.
A little bit of background. Andy is the former acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service, or CMS, under President Barack Obama. He was also appointed by the Obama administration to lead the turnaround of healthcare.gov following its rather bumpy rollout. The too long didn't read of that is that Andy oversaw programs that provide access to healthcare for over 140 million Americans. So he knows quite a bit about it and had a very unique POV at the American healthcare system. He joined Bloodstream Pod producer Ryan Geelan for an interview on how the Affordable Care Act has directly benefited people with rare chronic conditions like hemophilia and what we should be paying attention to in the next steps to repeal and replace or otherwise undermine it. That's coming up next, but real quick, first, just want to give a big shout out, as always, to the Bloodstream Podcast sponsor,
Shire.
We sincerely appreciate
Shire
making the Bloodstream Podcast and this interview with Andy possible. And for that, we say,
thank you, Shire.
Thank you, Shire.
Thanks for having me on the show, Ryan. I'm Andy Slavitt. I was in the Obama administration up until January of this year, overseeing the Affordable Care Act and the Medicare and the Medicaid programs.
Excellent. And when you say overseeing, if I'm not mistaken, you were sort of hands-on right there for the full 9 to 12 months of going all over the country, pitching the concept, reworking and working the concept until it was something passable. I mean, you were very hands-on and right sort of the forefront of the fight.
Well, during the Obama administration, I originally joined the administration after I got asked to lead the turnaround of the healthcare.gov website. So I was in the private sector, led the turnaround, and then came in and really oversaw the implementation. After I left in January, when it appeared the law was imperiled, rather than going back to the normal workforce, I decided that, along with many other people around the country, the most valuable thing I could do was devote my energy to making sure that we didn't lose the gains that we'd made during the ACA. So, among other things, I've been traveling around the country and having town halls, particularly in areas where Congress people or senators won't have town halls or won't meet with their citizens to explain what's going on with healthcare, to try to make it clear, to use social media, to use my Twitter feed and work with people and make sure that they understand exactly what's going on so they can be informed if they want to defend the gains that they've made in access to care, which are so important to millions of people.
And can I ask, why are there senators and congresspeople who won't hold town halls? Like, what constituency are they protecting or working for?
Well, that's a great question, because I think we all ought to expect of our senators and members of Congress that they represent us, that they want to hear from us. But I think what's happened is the vote to repeal the ACA and replace it with either nothing or something greatly inferior, it's been so unpopular that congressmen and senators have been avoiding their constituents in record numbers. And I think it's a really telltale question for our democracy, if you step back and think about it, which is, who do our elected representatives work for? Do they work for their party bosses? Do they work for the White House, which sometimes the president seems to imply? Or do they work for the people that put them in office? I think it's an extraordinarily important moment for people around the country to, I think, recognize that power of the elective body and make sure to send the messages to Congress that they do work for us.
And it seems like the Affordable Care Act, like one argument that people were making a year ago is that it's super unpopular and ineffective. And it seems like as people have come to know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are the same thing and that their access to Medicaid, for instance, is tied up in it, the popularity has increased. I think there's a headline just yesterday about historic popularity for it. Is that the case? Is the understanding of what it actually is increasing the popularity?
The ACA is enjoying record popularity, so you're right about that. So the question is sort of what happened and why did that turn around? And, you know, recall that for the last 6 to 7 years, the Republicans have been able to run on a single issue, which is saying that they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But what's important is they don't just say they want to repeal it. They talk about that the deductibles are too high, that the premiums are too high. And so when they come to introduce their own plan and the deductibles are 70% higher than the ACA and many fewer people can afford coverage and people lose access to vital protections like protections against being discriminated against or having a pre-existing condition or a lifetime max or things like that, and don't register with the American public, that's not what they wanted. That's not what they voted for. And in fact, while certainly not perfect, the Affordable Care Act took some important steps in the right direction.
Yeah, in our community especially, the idea of lifetime, people hit their lifetime caps often when they existed, they could hit their lifetime caps within months. And pre-existing conditions was essentially a way to guarantee that people with bleeding disorders wouldn't be covered by insurers. So those are two things that are really scary to our community. To take a quick step back for a second, it seems like, just to speak generally, it seems like the last 6 to 8 months in healthcare have been periods of calm punctured by these weeks-long periods of panicked phone calls, emails, town halls, advocacy organizations trying to rally together to save the Affordable Care Act. And for our community members who are new to this, either because of a newly diagnosed child or because they've lost their job or access to care, can you kind of describe generally what's going on and why we seem to keep having the same fight every couple of months?
Sure. And first, let me make a comment on your first point, which is that, and particularly for the hemophilia community, this is very important. Up until 2009, it's as if insurance was designed for the benefit of insurance companies. So all the things that would be necessary to protect you if you were an insurance company, that you could suss out whether someone had the kind of medical history or even the kind of behavior or even the kind of life circumstances that would cause them to have an expensive medical expense, would allow you as an insurance company to not write them a policy. It goes beyond even people living with conditions like hemophilia, but people who are living with domestic violence were often denied insurance and could be denied for any reason. So, you know, the important compact change of the American public that was made with the ACA is to say, let's not design insurance for the insurance company. Let's design it for the insureds. And as easy as that sounds, that's a fairly significant change. It requires everybody to change how they do things. But as we've made enormous strides, and in point of fact, there are so many people, so many communities that this helps, but that perhaps weren't vocal about how important those gains were. And I think what's happening now, as you rightly point out, is as the Republicans have attempted to say, hey, let's fulfill, and by the way, you know, when I say Republicans, this is not because I'm anti or pro one party or the other. This is just sort of the factual history, is that the Republican Party set out to fulfill it, what they believe to be their campaign promise of repealing and replacing the ACA. And it's gone through this process in Washington where it's gotten a lot of visibility. And for the first time, many people who have not been politically active are saying, hey, wait a minute. This is something that affects me and my community. And even more importantly, and I think more interestingly, there's a lot of people that have said, hey, wait a minute, this may not affect me, but this affects my neighbor or my cousin, or it affects the situation that I might be in at some point in time. So I think people have really learned very quickly about how to communicate with lawmakers and with Washington and to register their perspectives. And for that, I think we all ought to be very grateful. I know that I am.
And you mentioned people being better at communicating with their lawmakers and representatives. Are there two or three talking points or specific questions that you would suggest that people with chronic conditions or expensive conditions should focus on when reaching out to their reps? Because I know what we would recommend, but it would be great if you had specific talking points or thoughts about directions we could take those conversations. That would be very helpful.
Well, starting out by saying that people's circumstances and their medical histories are their own business, and that people obviously have to decide what they're personally comfortable with, whether it's their own condition or that of their kids. Personal stories are about as effective as anything. And, you know, so if you have a child that you believe is impacted by this or who would hit a lifetime max, or perhaps before the ACA, you hit a lifetime max, to the extent that people are willing to tell those stories and present them in very human terms, I think that's very helpful, because oftentimes we get numbed by the numbers and we forget how personal this is. So I think that is part of the message. I think the other components of the message are, you know, very much that we expect our lawmakers to take the things that work and applaud them, keep them going, and take the things that don't work and improve them. We don't expect people to politically tear down our laws that work for people. And I think we have a federal government right now that's, you know, not working on behalf of the people in the country, or most of the people in the country who want these protections and who want the surety of assurance. And we want our elected representatives to know how we feel, and we want them to speak up. And, you know, sometimes we have people who represent us who don't agree with us, in which case it's important to state our views. Sometimes we have elected representatives who do agree with our position, and that's good too. But even then, we need to make sure that they are speaking up and speaking loudly and clearly.
I think it's a great point, because a lot of people in our community are, like, bleeding. We say bleeding disorders do not discriminate, so it cuts across all socioeconomic statuses, all possible demos. Like, a lot of people are just not used to speaking publicly, talking openly about their challenges or the challenges of raising someone with a bleeding disorder, financial or otherwise. So to empower people that if you tell your story, you don't have to come in with a political science background. You don't have to come in with reams of research. Sometimes just telling your story can be as powerful as anything to lawmakers who might be a little disconnected from it.
That's absolutely right. And I think it helps people relate to somebody that they may know that have some condition. It may be hemophilia. It may be something else. But getting people to relate and understand is very, very important. And I really applaud you and the education that this podcast has provided, but and also the community who has really been very, very active and very, very focused. It doesn't take a lot of people if the messages are carried powerfully.
Thank you. This question may overlap with what you just said, and if so, we can jump ahead and skip it. But in your New York Times interview from August 9th, just a couple weeks ago, you mentioned that if you have 15 minutes, you can create a common bond around healthcare that cuts through politics. How do we begin to achieve that common bond, or where do you go with that?
You know, I think that the key is not to start with Washington speak. And, you know, when I often to talk to community people, you know, I say it doesn't matter if you voted for Donald Trump. It doesn't matter if you voted for Hillary Clinton or if you liked Obama or didn't like Obama. We all have a rooting interest in making the healthcare system work better for us. And we've all been in places where we've had frustrating and indeed very scary and vulnerable experiences when we've we've dealt with the healthcare system. And if you get back to those kitchen table issues, the fear that you will not have coverage, the fear that one of your children won't have coverage, the fear that you might go bankrupt from a medical bill, and think back that it was only 7 short years ago when that was incredibly common. You can get people to focus on and have a conversation that they really want. And so I encourage people, as difficult as it is, to the extent that you have friends, if you're listening to this podcast, and you have friends that may not agree with your point of view, or they may have a fortunate life, they may not have any chronic conditions, they may get their insurance through their job, they may not feel that threatened, but they're friends with you or they're related to you. Helping them understand what it's like for you in a way that they can relate to, because they're before the grace of God, as you say, any of us at any given moment could find ourselves in a different situation on a Tuesday than we found ourselves on a Monday. And so talking to your friends and neighbors, helping them understand, particularly people who may have voted for Trump or may not understand these issues, to understand that if their life circumstances had changed in the lottery of life just a small degree, they would be advocating for things that would hurt them. People get it. People do get it but they have to experience it and feel it. They're not going to be convinced by what they see on cable TV.
Two last questions. Philosophically, do you believe that healthcare is a right?
Yes.
Not something that we should have to fight for in the wealthiest country on earth. It's something that is a right, just like police having safety in our communities through police, having a fire department, having good schools. It's on par with those things.
Well, if, God forbid, my child or your child went missing and you called the police department, they wouldn't ask you for a copayment. They wouldn't ask you to read them some insurance number. We have adults, we have young adults around the country that can't lead productive lives if they are spending it worrying about their health care. We won't have a productive society. So these aren't easy issues. There's trade-offs to make. And in fact, I authored a piece in JAMA, the Journal of American Medicine, which you could probably put a link to on your site, that really is a message for how we should be having the next major healthcare reform battle, if in fact we believe that healthcare is a right and we should be moving in that direction. Because it's not so much as just showing up and saying, hey, here's a great slogan, I want Medicare for all. It's more complicated than that. And I take about 750 words and I put it into this piece, which is, I think, intended to help frame how we should approach the next battle, presuming we escape this one with healthcare intact.
Excellent. We'll definitely link to it in the notes. My final question. So you've talked a lot about like helping others through this. You know, a lot of the answers revolve around what is good for the community, what is good for Americans. But I'm curious to know why you do what you do. Like, no one devotes their life to working toward better healthcare access for all Americans for the money, you know? So why are you personally so passionate about this?
Well, look, I'm 50 years old. I've got an incredibly fortunate life. I've got a wonderful family. I've had a great career. I had the opportunity to serve in government for a president who I believe really wants to change and wanted to change the country for the better. And he and many, many other people set a great example for me. And many people in this country don't have the luxury of taking on these fights or these challenges because I'm quite aware that they have their own illnesses and they have their own family situations and they have to, get up and go to work every day and worry about those things. So, when you find yourself in the fortunate position that I am in, where I've been around healthcare my whole life, have served in government, understand it well enough, and have spent the last 2 years serving over 100 million Americans in the Medicare, Medicaid program and the ACA, and watch them struggle and eventually many of them rejoice with their access to care, it's not something you want to give up easily. So it's been an opportunity, I think I'm fortunate enough to be able to be a part of, but I'm one of many, many, many people who are, I believe in this. So I don't think, other than perhaps my larger visibility, that it's anything particularly special compared to others. But I would also say if you want to keep track and stay close to what's happening and continue to support what's happening, I invite you to follow me on my Twitter feed, which is at aslavitt. And that is where I think I will continue to attempt to keep people as informed as possible about what's going on and what they can do.
Awesome. We will put the link to that as well. This has been incredible, and I think our community will benefit a lot from it. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you to Andy Slavitt for coming on the Bloodstream podcast for what I thought was a really informative interview with a lot of specific talking points and takeaways about the value of the ACA and the importance of having good quality healthcare here in the U.S. Anything in particular, Natalie, that stuck out to you from that interview?
That he stated healthcare is a human right.
Yeah, pretty clearly, pretty definitively.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost disarmingly so. You know, and it's something that I appreciate too about Andy's writing is he's seen the healthcare system from the private sector and the public side at the highest of levels, and you just have a lot of information at your disposal when you've been in those positions. And I like this quote from him that I read from something he published in July. "One thing I've learned is that the desire to have a regular source of care and not worry about going bankrupt from a medical bill is not a partisan sentiment. It's a human one. And when the human system depends on the vagaries of who's in power in Washington, no one can sleep well at night." And I think that's an important point to make. I know I can feel a little ideologically in my corner when it comes to things like healthcare. But I think his point is probably true, right? No one's like looking for a really expensive bill that could completely overturn their life, no matter what their political ideology may be. They want good care, and they want to make sure that financially it's not going to corrupt them to have it.
Well, and I think when it comes to policy, both sides get lost in the minutiae of things and sometimes forget that these policies are policies for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And especially healthcare.
Yeah, not team R or team D or team
no,
I.
No, it's team human.
Yeah, it's team human. So thank you, Andy. Thank you, Ryan, for setting that up. And I hope you all found that valuable. There are links to the article that Andy references, as well as some other information about or other articles from Andy that you might find interesting in the program notes. One last time, just want to remind you that the Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Shire, and we are extremely grateful to them for supporting our efforts to educate the community through podcasting. And for that, as always, we say
thank you, Shire.
Now the episode 16 parting shots. One thing to leave you with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise, before Natalie and I sign off and say goodbye until next month. I'll kick us off my parting shot for this week. We talked earlier in the podcast about the Florida and the Texas chapters. One other organization that I want to highlight that does a lot for people in the community that are going through what they call seasons of crises and is also geographically not too far from the epicenters of these two storms is Hope for Hemophilia, headed up by community member Jonathan James out of Louisiana. They do a tremendous amount of work to financially and otherwise help community members who are going through particularly tough, as Jonathan says, seasons in their life and journey with hemophilia. So if you're not familiar with Hope for Hemophilia, I would suggest you take a look at their work. They do some really awesome stuff. And Jonathan is a committed and superb community member, and I'm sure they'd be happy to hear from you. Hopeforhemophilia.org. We'll also have links in the program notes. And Natalie, what do you got for us?
So my parting shot is one unexpected thing that I got out of NHF this year is a community member approached me, and she is also a doula, and she asked if she could be my mentor, and I've been looking for a mentor, and she lives here in Southern California. Her name is Meredith Page. And I'm just really excited because to meet someone within the bleeding disorders community who's also a part of a community that's important to me, and that we can collaborate together and maybe help change birth within the bleeding disorders community. Who knows? But it's very exciting to gain a mentor at NHF.
And that is all for this episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast and all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community by visiting bloodstreammedia.com. You can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. This episode of the Bloodstream Podcast was written by Patrick James Lynch, Natalie Lynch, and Lawrence Woolard. Produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Geelan, Rob Bradford, Andrew Gall, Josh Bragg, Heather Robb, Ava Friedman, and Colby Crow. And the Bloodstream Podcast is edited, as always, by Mr. Andrew Gall. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, Lawrence Woolard, Andy Slavitt, and our sponsor, Shire. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself.